On behalf of the congregation that meets on Race Street, I'd like to express to the administration the appreciation of the church for the use of these facilities during this period of transition. And I suppose it's not something that they could have done otherwise about, because they're so much involved in one as the other that I think they asked themselves if they could use their own facilities, and they answered, yes, we'll use it. I want to read tonight from Exodus, the 14th chapter, verses 10 through 15, and take from it a lesson for us tonight. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they were in great fear. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us to bring us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Let us alone, and let us serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you'll have only to be still." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." These words of strong encouragement were spoken to the Hebrew people at, I suppose, the most crucial time of their history. Their future hopes, their plans, their dreams, their very lives were at stake. And now we find them in a position that was not very favorable. They looked backward and saw Pharaoh's army camping upon their flank. They perhaps saw the battle array being drawn up and the trumpet or the ram's horn being prepared for blowing to signal the approach. And then on the right and left there were mountains or hills, and on the front of them there was the sea. And they saw no real way of escape. And these words of encouragement were spoken to them at a very crucial time, as you can see in their history. These words were spoken to give direction to God's people. These people, in their particular time, these were the words spoken to them specifically, these Jews in the birth of their nation, the Israelites. And yet to us and to all of God's people in every age, there's something in these two exhortations, stand still and go forward. There is a lesson in these two exhortations for all of us who claim to be God's people. Tonight, I want to make application of these to you and me in what I believe to be a critical time in our history. We're facing an important time as we approach the expanding of the facilities, as we approach an expanded work, as we approach an expanded student body to serve. I think we can use these exhortations and these encouragements to good use tonight. These words, at first glance, appear to be a contradiction. They appear to be a paradox. Stand still and go forward. I can hear some of the malcontents saying, "Make up your mind, Moses. What's wrong? What do you want us to do? Stand still or go forward?" Well, it didn't come quite like that. But had it, I could have suspected that it was about like our enlisted men used to think about the army. The enlisted men always grumbled about the army that the only two commandments they ever gave was hurry up and wait. And they always got them there, you know, and then they had to stand in line. But here, that's not quite what happened. Moses was giving them two distinct commandments, and when he told these people to stand still, as is recorded in the King James Version, he was not simply telling them to stand motionless. He was telling them, don't break your ranks. Don't run. You stand firm, as the Revised Standard translates it, which gives the meaning that Moses was trying to convey. But even at that, about all that Moses was able to do was to encourage these people to maintain the status quo. And for these people, it meant maintaining the mess that we're in, because they considered themselves to be in a mess. But it took God's direction to really give any positive solution to their problem. All Moses could say was stand still. God didn't tell them to stand still. It was Moses that told them to stand still. God told them to go forward. And he told Moses, tell the people, why are you crying to me? Go forward. Take off. I'm with you. I'll fight for you. But these two give us an insight into the mind of these people. They give us an insight into the frame of thinking that these people were in at this particular time, and they also give us an insight into the reason why these people failed in the final analysis. These people had a particular frame of mind that spelled disaster from the day that they left the land of Egypt. Let me get back up just for a few moments and give you the background and the circumstances that surrounded the Israelites in the land of Egypt. It's very simple. These people were slaves. In Exodus, the first chapter, it describes how that the people made these people's work one of rigor and bitterness, and that they put them to work in the brick and the mortar and in the work of the field, and how that in all of their work they made the people serve with rigor. These people were slaves. They hadn't always been slaves. There was a time when the land of Egypt was favorable to the Israelite nation. There was a time when it was good to them. When the young man Joseph had gone through his period of trial and then was elevated to the position second behind only the king, Pharaoh learned that Joseph's parents or his father and his brethren were needing to come into Egypt for grain. He sent Joseph to get his father and his brothers. And when they came down, he said, Joseph, the whole of Egypt is before you. You place your father and your brothers in the best part of the land. Put them in the land of Goshen, he said. And he gave them the best part of the land. And for years, throughout the life of Joseph, Israel was a favored nation in the land of Egypt. But there came a time when that ended, because they began to multiply beyond the capability of Egypt to contain them. There arose a king that didn't know Joseph. And he began to call his advisors to him and said, now listen, we've got a problem on our hands. These Israelites are multiplying faster than we can contain them. They're becoming more powerful. They're becoming too many for us to contain. Unless they side with an enemy who might attack us and get out of here and escape from us, we better deal craftily with them. And so they set up over them certain taskmasters and began to exact from them service that characterized a slave people, and they reduced them to the position of abject slavery. But there's something more than just slavery that was the plight of these people. These people had become institutionalized. And brethren, there's a great difference between being a slave and being an institutionalized slave. You know what it means to be institutionalized? To be institutionalized or to become institutionalized is to develop a frame of mind wherein you are more confident and more sure and more comfortable being treated as a slave, being handed out your rations, being guarded and protected and cared for, even in the state of slavery. You come to the place where you would rather be there than on the outside, responsible for your own keeping and dealing with the problems that confront you every day. There are those in prisons today by the thousands who have become institutionalized. I worked with a prisoner for 4 years, eventually was able to have him released. He got outside the prison, went completely berserk. He wasn't capable of coping with the outside pressures and found himself resorting to the same kind of life that had put him in there before, and it seemed to me like he was doing it on purpose. While he was in jail, he had all of his food, he had his clothing, he had his work laid out for him, and the walls and the prison guards protected him from the outside world and all the pressures. And he was just as content to live there. He had become institutionalized. I think that's what had happened to these people here. Let me give you another definition of institutionalized thinking. It is that thinking that would rather walk by sight than by faith. That's what institutionalized means. And when you look at it through that definition, many of us perhaps are institutionalized in our lives, because there's not a person, or there are seldom people living as Christians who would rather walk by faith as to walk by sight. We all, by nature, humanly, would rather walk by sight than to walk by faith. But these people, as I say, became institutionalized. This can be seen in 3 or 4 ways. I'm just going to mention this in passing. It was seen in their initial rejection of Moses. You remember the day that Moses went out and said, when he was grown up. I don't know how old he was, probably 16. You think you're grown when you're 16, don't you? He was probably 30. And he went out and he began to go around and see how the people were faring. And he saw one of the taskmasters beating one of his own brethren, one of the Israelites. And he looked this way and he looked that way, and then he walked up to the man and he hit him and killed him and buried him in the sand. Didn't think anybody had seen him. The next day he was out there again, sauntering around and trying to do some good, and he saw two of his own brethren arguing. He waited a moment and saw which one he felt like was in error, and he went up to him and said, "Sir, why are you treating your brother like that?" And this man turned on him and said, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? In other words, mind your own business. This man stole my trowel, and I'm going to get it back to, from him if it kills him." And sure enough, they fought back and forth. I don't know whether it was his trowel or not, but I'm simply saying that it was some trivial something that really didn't amount to all that much. But Moses was put on his guard because the man said, "Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" But the rejection of this man was simply this. They didn't want anybody tampering with their personal lives. They had their petty gripes. They had their petty involvements. And here came this man trying to interrupt these things and get them to follow a different course. And they said, "Moses, mind your own business. Nobody had given you this job. You haven't been made a prince or a ruler over us." The second thing that indicates that they were institutionalized is seen in the fact that whenever this idea was presented to them that they could leave this bondage and get out of Egypt, that they could go on and inherit the land of promise that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they rejected it hands down, didn't want to have anything to do with it. God told them in Exodus, the 6th chapter, he gave Moses specific instructions about what to say. And Moses went down there and told them exactly what God said. "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I promised them that I would bring you out of the land of Egypt and bring you into a land flowing with milk and honey. I will deliver you out of this bondage." The Bible says in verse 9 of that chapter that Moses told them these words, and they said to Moses, "We don't want to hear it." It said they would not listen to him because of their broken spirit and because of their hard bondage. They didn't have any resiliency left. They had no initiative left. They'd had it all knocked out of them. And here came this dreamer. Here came this prince. Here came this man that probably never had lifted a brick in his life, they would say. And I can just imagine them saying, "Well, what do you know about it? You and your visionary ideas, get on out of here. I've got 1,000 bricks to make by this afternoon. I hadn't even started yet. And here I sit talking to you." You can hear all the grumbling and the griping. They just didn't want to be confronted with any idea that would put them out on a limb and put them in situations that they had not been accustomed to living in. They didn't like new ideas. And yet it wasn't a new idea at all. This had been a part of their history. But as far as they were concerned, they weren't able to cope with it because they'd been institutionalized. A third thing that shows that they were institutionalized, whenever they finally did get out of the land of Egypt, when they met crises, they panicked. When they got down to the Red Sea and the mountains on each side and the Red Sea in the front, someone in the rear said, "Look at the dust. Here comes Pharaoh and his army. Have mercy on us." And boy, that swept through the ranks of the Israelite people. They set up a howl. If you could have taken the blood pressure of those people, you'd have put them all in the hospital, because it sure shot up there that when they heard Pharaoh was coming. Yours would have too. What would you have done had you known Pharaoh was coming? You've been in prison. You've been a slave for 400 years. What would you have done if here came your slave masters with an army numbering into the thousands? Well, they had become so institutionalized that they really panicked. And then fourth, you see how they were institutionalized by the way whenever they were called upon to sacrifice, they weren't able to do it. When hardship met them, they began to crumble. Oh, we find about a month or so after they had gotten out of the land of Egypt and they were sitting over there in the wilderness and they started grumbling. Somebody said, "Oh, if we just had something to eat besides this manna. Oh, I remember when we had the leeks and the garlics and the melons and all this. Do you remember that fish we used to eat in Egypt? It didn't cost us anything," they said. "And now we sit here and all we can look at is this manna." And you almost hear them say, "Yick." In fact, I guess that's probably where the word "yick" came from. I'd hear this. It sounds like a guttural anyway. It looks like a guttural Hebrew word, "yick." But they sure didn't want that manna. And began to grumble when they were called upon to sacrifice. They had been institutionalized to the point that they had been literally rendered useless as far as doing anything that God had asked them to do in faith. Now, what was their trouble? The basic problem with the Jewish people here, the Hebrew people, was the simple fact that they hadn't left God any margin. They hadn't made allowance for God at all. No margin for him. This can be illustrated very easily and demonstrated in their response to God when he told them to go into the land of Canaan. About 6 weeks after they left the land of Egypt, God told Moses, Moses, send some spies into the land of Egypt to spy out the land, or into the land of Israel, Canaan, to spy out the land, and have them come back and tell us what kind of people they are, whether they're weak or strong, whether the cities are fortified, or whether they live in camps, whether the land is poor or rich, whether the people are large or tall or small or whatever. Go in there and find out. He said, find out if there's any wood in the country, and then have them come back and report to you. So Moses did. They stayed a week. They stayed 2 weeks. They stayed three and four. Finally, they came back after 40 days searching out the land. They went into the valley of Eshcol, where they cut down a cluster of grapes. The word Eshcol means cluster. And they cut down this cluster of grapes that was so big, they had to carry it between them, two of them, on a stick. And they brought this cluster of grapes back. I think that this cluster of grapes that was represented here, or that was used here, as evidence of the fruitfulness of the land, I think it still is used, whether it's an official symbol or not, I don't know, but they still use it in the land of Israel today. But nevertheless, they sent the spies out. They came back. The 10 spies spoke first. They said, it is a good land. It's flowing with milk and honey. But the people are humongous. They're terrible. They're giants. The Anakim are there. And all these other nations are there. And their cities are monstrous. They're walled. And the people are giants. And we just can't take them. The next verse says that Caleb quieted the people. It doesn't say the people went up in arms, that they went up in uproar. It just says that Caleb got up and quieted the people. Well, you know what happened. When these 10 men came back and said, we can't take it. We're going to die as sure as we go in there. Caleb got up and said, wait just a minute. Everything's not that bad. He said, it's a good land and God has promised it to us. Let's go in and take it now. They stated one statement is all that Caleb and Joshua got to make. One statement. And these other 10 men stood up and interrupted them and said, we cannot go in. As sure as we go in, we'll die. He said, we look like grasshoppers in their eyes. And that's the way we look to them. We look like grasshoppers to them. We cannot go in. The Bible says that they lifted up a cry. They began to weep and to mourn. All the congregation raised a loud cry. The people wept that night. And all the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to him, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. Why does the Lord bring us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones, who they'll become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? This was their response. They rejected the two men who said, we can take it. They accepted the verdict of the 10 men that said, we cannot take it. They said, look, wouldn't it be better if we just went on back to Egypt now and surrendered to Pharaoh? And don't you know they even started to elect them a leader? They said, let's go and choose a captain and go back to Egypt. Exodus, the 14th chapter and verse 4. They were on their way back. They were making their plans to go back. Moses and Joshua and Caleb fell on the face before this congregation and said, don't do this. Joshua said, don't sin against the Lord. Don't rebel against the Lord. You stay in there and fight. You do what he says. You be true to the Lord. You know what they did to Caleb and Joshua? They tried to stone them. The idea, telling us we can go in and take the land. Look at those people. Look at the cities. Look at their weapons. We don't have anything but these hoes. We have nothing but these things that we do with agriculture. And they've got all these chariots and everything. How do you think we're going to take them? They didn't leave God any margin. Their problem was that they had no concept of a God who could bless and carry out his word. They just didn't have a concept of a God like that. They were ignorant. They didn't have any belief. They had no faith. But this idea or this concept of their failure to leave God a margin is also seen in the fact of their rejection of God's command to not go into the land of Canaan. After they had said, we can't go in, after they said, let's go back to Egypt, let's choose a captain and go back into Egypt, after that, God appeared to Moses and said, Moses, this people will not come into my land of Canaan. They'll not come into my rest. Their dead bodies will drop in the wilderness until every last one of them, from 20 years old and up, is dead. Not a single one of them will come into the land of Canaan. Moses went back to the children of Israel and reported this from God. And the people then, they wept again. They said, oh, we've sinned. Early the next morning, a group of them got up and went up the hill,
looked over into the land of Canaan, came running back, and they said, "Why, we're already there. Let's go in. God has given us a land. Let's go in and take it." Moses said, "You better not go in. If you know what's good for you, you better not go in. You're going to get driven back because God is not with you. He's not going to fight for you." They said, "Oh, we can make it on our own." And I'm not standing here if the very ones that said we cannot go in when God said go in, when God then said don't go in, they said we can go in. Can you imagine such as that? They had no concept of God, you see, as being able to punish and destroy them. They had no concept of Him being able to bless them and do them good. They also had no concept of God that could punish and destroy them. They just simply did not have an awareness of God. Do you know what faith is? Faith is this thing of leaving God a margin. And they didn't leave God any margin. And as a result, they were disobedient. And in Hebrews, the 3rd chapter, in verse 19, it says, we see that they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. But let me show you something that scares me. These people were caused to fail to enter the land of Canaan because they had faithless leaders. That's right. Let me read you a passage. After this whole thing came out and the ball burst and all this corruption and all and the faithlessness and all, listen to what it said. And the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land and who returned and made all the congregation to murmur against him by bringing in an evil report against the land, the men who brought up an evil report of the land died by plague before the Lord. But listen to this statement. The ones who returned and made all the congregation to murmur against God by bringing up an evil report against the land. This text said that the leaders caused or made these people, coerced them, forced them, that the very fact of their false report, of their report of unbelief, that very report made the entire congregation of some 3 million people rebel against God. They had a faithless leadership. I wonder what would have been the result had all 12 of those men come back and said, there are a lot of people in there that can fight. It's a good land. It flows with milk and honey. And they're big people. But they don't have God like we've got God. We have Jehovah fighting for us. We can go in. Let's go. There wouldn't have been a dissenting voice, I dare say, among the congregation. But they didn't have that kind of leadership. What a shame. What a shame. And so they weren't able to enter in because of unbelief. And if you were to take a pick and shovel and go over to that land and dig and follow the tracks of that company of people from Egypt to Israel, you would find the dead bodies of every last one of those people from 20 years old and upward, except Caleb and Joshua. Every last one of them fell in the wilderness because they didn't give God a margin. Now, I want to make an application for us. Or you could make many applications. One application you could make for you students, you've come out of bondage. You got away from home. But by the time you've eaten paddy cob food for about 3 months, you're going to be wanting to go back. Or heritage either, for that matter. You'd give anything you have if you had one bowl of soup and a piece of cornbread from your mama at her table, or a bowl of cornbread and some buttermilk. No. That's the other generation. Phew, not me either. But you're going to be saying, oh, don't you remember those hamburgers that mama used to make? And you're going to be saying when you walk through the line, what in the world is that? You're going to be murmuring. That's right. You're going to get in trouble over it. I'm going to preach on it one day. You're going to get in trouble. God says, don't you murmur. And it was over food that these people murmured. Most of their murmuring was over food. And most of your grumbling is going to be over food this year. The rest of it's going to be over these rules that have been imposed on you. But the real application that I want to make is simply this. It pertains to those of us in this congregation, students and adults, resident members and student members, as we go through this transition, and the application is clear to us. The facilities over on Race Street were good for a while. For some years, they served us well. And they facilitated and expedited our carrying out of the Great Commission. And we were proud to have them, and they were good to us. But the time came that times changed, and we had grown too large in order for them to accommodate us. And instead of their becoming something that facilitated and encouraged, they became that which discouraged and that hindered us. We weren't really able to carry out what we needed to do. We weren't really able to do the work that God had given us to do. And our elders then challenged us, let's move out. Let's go forward. Stand still. Don't break your ranks. Let's go forward and do what God has asked us to do. And so here we sit. We've already moved out. The Red Sea's already behind us. You're already here in the wilderness. You know it? And today, for the first time, you've seen all the difficulties that are surrounding us and everything that the things that are not very commodious, the heat. I apologize, Enoch, for the heat up there. I know y'all are hot. Well, you can get used to it for about the next 6 months. This is it. And you know what you're saying? Oh, if we just had an air conditioner. Sure. And I don't blame you. If I was sitting up there, I would be too. Don't murmur, though. You're liable to catch it. But this sort of thing, we're going to have to become accustomed to. Something's going to have to give. Whenever we face these oppositions, whenever we face things that are uncomfortable, whenever we're challenged to do something that almost seems unbelievable, whenever we're challenged to get outside of our petty goings-on that, you know, that occupy us every day, how are we going to conduct ourselves? Well, there are about three alternatives that you can do. We're already out in the wilderness. The Red Sea's behind us. The land of Egypt is back over yonder that at one time was favorable to us, but no longer is. And here we sit in this wilderness. What are you going to do? Well, you can do three things. You can either select a leader and say, let's go back over there. They haven't torn it down yet. And you can go over there and tell those people, just hold up everything. We're not going to leave. We're going to come back in and we're going to go and we're going to meet there. So you see, we were out of debt. We didn't know a penny over there. You didn't know that, did you? You never would have come out had you known we were free of debt, would you? You can go back if you want to. Or you can follow the suggestion of the leaders here that say that we can pay $500,000 back in 3 years. Who in the world ever thought of that? Well, our elders did. Stone them. Well, that's what they suggested here. Caleb and Joshua came back and said, we can take it. God is with us. They said, stone those men. We can't do it. What in the world's the matter with you? Who do you think we are? They didn't allow any allowance for God. Or you can do this. You can go on and march about 20 years in the wilderness of interest. These brethren want to get rid of this interest. If we wait and finance this thing over a 20-year period, it's going to cost us about $360,000 of interest. Brethren, I don't want to wander that long in the wilderness of interest, frankly. I'd rather go on and take what is coming and do what God wants us to do and do it and go on into the land of Canaan without having to wait and then our dead bodies drop along the way and our children enter in a debt-free building. I don't want that. I want to go in there myself. But what are you going to do about it? Well, it depends on whether or not you leave God a margin. If you leave him a margin for him to operate, then we'll walk by faith and not by sight. And you know where the key will lie? It'll lie in the leadership. But here's something very interesting and strange. The leadership that was the deciding factor in this failure of the Jews to go into the land of Canaan was not the leadership of Moses. It was not the eldership leadership. The leadership that was the critical deciding factor in this failure of the Jewish people was that leadership that was selected from among the congregation. They knew what Moses was going to do. They knew he was going to do what the Lord asked him to do regardless. It wasn't Moses that was in question. It was the decision of these people who were serving as leaders from among the people. They were the ones that were the critical factor in this matter. They chose someone from every tribe and sent them into the land of Canaan. They were the ones that came back and said, we cannot take it. And you know what's happened today in this thing of our leadership today? The elders, you know what they're going to do. They're going to do what faith dictates that they do. They were out ahead of me. I wasn't willing to go that route. They were saying, we're not going to drop off one single penny from our mission budget. When they said that, I thought, oh boy, you brethren are really asking for it. You're not going to make it. Yeah, I'm sorry, and I apologize for that. Harry, I'm really embarrassed about it. And on top of that, there was $36,000 that the church had been giving into the Iowa, wasn't it Iowa? Des Moines, Iowa campaigns. $36,000 now was the support. We'd been doing it for 10 years. Our 10-year period was up. The decision was to be made. Are we going to continue it, or are we going to build the building? You know what the elders said? We're going to continue it, and now, number two, we're going to double it. Instead of having $36,000 to give to them, we're going to give them $72,000, and we're going to build the building on top of that. I started going around and telling some of these brethren that I thought I could hoodwink. I said, look, you better not do that. Now's the time to drop off of that mission program for about 3 years, and then we can do this building and go back to the mission program. They said, no, we're not going to do that. They're men of faith. They're men of faith. But now watch. That's not the leadership that's in question. There are representatives from among our brethren, our ranks here, that are leading us. And I don't doubt what there's some coming back and saying we can't do it. But let me tell you about some of them that say we can. Charles Darwin, one of our brethren here, who is the custodian of the building, he doesn't make a lot of money. But he brought a $1,000 check by to the elders and said, I want to be the first one to give $1,000 to build this building. Where in the world did he get $1,000? I don't know. I think perhaps he may have cashed in an insurance policy. A virtual widow came into the office the other day and said, I have some money that's come through back pay to my husband, and I want to know what to do with it so that it can be used in the work of the Lord. Do you have any suggestions? I said, do I? But here she was, virtually a widow, and she's wanting to give money. And I said, have you got $1,000 you want to give to it? She said, yes, I do. Roy Taylor, who is a widower living on Social Security, he says, I want to give $200 or $300 or $400. I don't know what the amount was. These are people who have stood up among the congregation saying, we want to do this like the elders are suggesting that we do it. And it's been suggested that every family give $1,000. Pay it off over the 3 years, borrow it, take it out of your insurance policies. They don't care. It can be done. And they're suggesting that we pay off $500,000 in 3 years. I say again, stone them. It's just unbelievable. And yet, if you let God have a margin, we can do it. What are you going to do about it? Well, it just depends on whether or not you're going to be like the Israelite people, the majority, or whether you're going to be like Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua had God in their plans. The other people didn't. Do you? I think, frankly, that if this congregation will respond, and I'm sure that you will, you'll find the same thing happening here as happened to the Creswell Church down in Shreveport, Louisiana, where Al Jolly went last year. In one day, they raised $400,000. They gave it. $400,000. And they're not half the size that we are. And they don't have all these young people either. I know what will happen, and I'm thankful to be a part of it. May God bless you in your decision. Will you listen to the 10 spies, or will you listen to the 2? Will you suggest that we go back into Egypt, or will you suggest that we stone those that stood up and said, let's give 1,000? Or what are you going to do? Or will you say like Caleb and Joshua, it's a very good plan, God is with us, and we can accomplish it. Stand still. Don't you break your ranks, and go forward. All you need to do, he says, is watch. And let the Lord work through you. Let the Lord deliver you this very day. May God bless us. Whatever may be your part that you can contribute, whether you're a student or a resident member of this church, do your share and let God have a margin. In Ephesians 3, 19 and 20, he simply says this. He's described there as the God who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you ask or think. That's the kind of God we serve. All that you ask or think is what you can do. He says God is the God who can do exceeding abundantly above all that you ask and think. Now that's the margin that we have in God. May God bless us. Let us stand to the challenge.
Join in a song with sweet accord. Join in a song with sweet accord. And thus around the throne, and thus around.